the rake holder.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. It is right about 1 o'clock on January 13th, so I'm going to call the meeting of the Utility Finance Oversight Committee to order. With that, Danielle, welcome. Would you give a roll call, please?
Chairperson Bennett?
Here.
Vice Chair Bowling?
Here.
Member Johnston?
Here.
Member Scott?
Here.
Member Maples? A quorum is present.
Thank you, Danielle. With that, we'll start the meeting out with public comment. The public is invited at this time to comment on and discuss any topic that is relevant to or within the authority of the Utility Finance Oversight Committee, including any matter that is not specifically included on the agenda as an action item. No action may be taken on a matter raised under public comment unless the item has been specifically included on the agenda as an item upon which action may be taken. So with that, I'm looking for anybody who has public comment. Seeing none, I'll close public comment and we'll move on to agenda item number one. Item 1A for possible action, discussion and possible action regarding approval of our November 4th, 2019 draft meeting minutes. Has everybody had a chance to review the minutes? And if so, are there any questions or modifications that we need? And if not, I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move approval of the minutes as presented.
I have a motion by Member Scott.
Second.
Second by Member Bowling. If no further discussion, I'll take a vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries 4-0. So that moves us right along to item 2A, which is for possible action and discussion to recommend annual water and wastewater rate increases to the Board of Supervisors. So with that, I'm going to look at Andy.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you, Chairman Bennett. For the record, Andy Hummel, Wastewater Utility Manager, Carson City. I'm going to introduce this item for our consultant, Far West. We contracted with them in 2019 to review our wastewater and water rates. Last rate study was performed in 2012, which resulted in pretty steep increases in both the water and sewer funds at that time. But those hard decisions made then left us in a pretty good position now, which they're going to show us in a few minutes. They'll review, you know, that background of what happened last time, policies and assumptions built into that model, and model results of the current effort, providing a five-year outlook. Throughout the presentation and in the staff report, call-outs to a proposed effective date of rate changes of January 1st, 2021. That was a last-minute clerical mess up on our part. The model results being presented today are based on a July 1, 2020 proposed implementation. Doing that on the fiscal year basis tends to make people in the financial world, since that's how we do our budgets, they really appreciate that happening on a fiscal basis. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Brent Farr and Alexa Kissinger, our consultants.
Hi, my name is Alexa Kinsinger, and I work for Far West Engineering, and I was the lead in the effort to update the existing water and wastewater rate model that was originally created by the FCS group in 2012. With me here is Brent Farr of Far West Engineering for moral support and assistance. So starting off with a little background of what we're going to go through today. First, just presenting background on the existing rates and connection fees that were established in 2012, and then financial policies and assumptions that are used in the FCS model that Carson City uses for their water and wastewater rates. And then third will be review of the model results for the rate changes proposed for fiscal year 2021 through 2025. So, as mentioned previously, in 2012, Carson City contracted with FCS Group to complete a cost of service rate study. In this effort, they developed a rate model that proposed rates effective fiscal year 2013 through 18, and their model phased in a cost of service over that time period. So that means that the cost of to provide water and wastewater utility service was distributed amongst customer classes and phased in through the five-year period to get to the rates that are currently present. This effort resulted in a 15% yearly increase to the wastewater rate and a 6.5% increase to the water rate. As you can see, those are pretty large increases, but through that effort, it got Carson City utilities to a really strong point, as we'll discuss later. One item that did not get approved by the Board of Supervisors was FCS recommended connection fee at that time. So in 2012, they remained at the existing connection fee. So then in 2015, Carson City was faced with some issues in their connection fees because they did not take recommended routes. But through an ordinance, the city adopted a connection fee through 2020 and onward that indexes the connection fee at an ENRCCI index with a cap of a 3% increase each year. So that's the current system now. And as you can see, the connection fee that will be effective in July 1st, 2020 for each system, wastewater is $4,493. And water per water equivalent residential customer is $3,440. So that connection fee is set through ordinance to be indexed on the ENRCCI. So here we are to today. In 2019, we were contracted to update that existing FCS water and wastewater model. A couple nuances there. We did not modify anything that FCS took in their approach. So the financial policies established then carried through till today. The model that we updated will be recommending rates effective 2021 through 25. And then due to the success of the 2012 FCS model, which phased in that cost of service, we have now gotten it to a point where the rates are just proposed to be increased across the board, every customer class experiencing the same rate increase, because we don't need to phase it in anymore. It already got phased in over the past 5 years. So now we'll be moving on to the financial policies and the FCS model assumptions that are used to establish these rates. We have six different items to cover, the first being the operating reserves. So within the wastewater fund, the goal is 30 to 45 days of O&M cash expense on hand. And then in wastewater is 60 to 90 days of O&M expense cash on hand. These are industry standards typically for these goals. And then when operating reserves exceed the maximum target of those O&M days, excess cash is transferred from operating into the capital account to help cover capital projects. So the second assumption is the capital account minimum target balance right there. That's set to 2% of the system fixed assets. This is just a best management practice to ensure that the capital account has a target to reach, and this was established in the FCS 2012 model. Next, the capital funding account. So the model assumes that the capital projects that are not funded through the capital fund balance will be funded through bond sales. What we did was we kept the capital account, kept the available funding in the capital account as close to that minimum target, that 2% system fixed assets, to avoid bond sales as often as possible. So that was one of our goals within the capital funding account. Next is the debt service coverage goals. So the rates include a minimum coverage factor of 1x the annual debt service. In 2012, an internal goal of 1.25x the annual debt service was established. So that was where we shot for. And then that also includes a debt to equity ratio goal of no greater than 50% debt to equity or cash.
If I could interrupt you just real quick. Yeah. The goals and policies that you described, they look very familiar. I'm assuming they match the board's adopted financial policies. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, we didn't change any of these goals.
Okay.
This process.
I just want to clarify that. Thank you.
No problem. So moving on to the fifth goal is system reinvestment funding, also known as depreciation funding. So it is funded through rates using a percent of the annual depreciation expense goal as a benchmark for the appropriate funding level. So here I have the water system reinvestment funding strategy. The 2013 through 2019 show what the FCS model 2012 established. As you can see, in both the water and wastewater fund, depreciation was not being funded at the beginning of their study period, which is one reason there were such steep increases to the water and wastewater rates back in 2012. But the FCS model got the water system up to 100% system reinvestment by 2018, and then the wastewater system, unfortunately, only got to 80%. As you can see in the 2020 through 2025 timeframe, these are the goals that we set as a group for system reinvestment over the next 5 years. The water system stays steady at 100% system reinvestment funding each year. And the wastewater system, by 2025, we were able to get it up to 95% depreciation funding with the proposed rate increases that we will go over shortly. I can revisit this a little bit later if you guys would like, but this is where we got it with these current results. So lastly are just the economic and financial factors that we used for projecting the expenditures over the next 5 years. Everything in black writing was included in the FCS 2012 model, and then we added two other line items, one being the Engineering News Records Construction Cost Index, the ENRCCI. Over the next 5 years, we assumed a 2.5%, but that does vary year to year, and that was to help us predict connection fees in the future, considering they are currently indexed by ordinance. And then the other item that was added is the Marlette cost inflation, and that only applies to the water rate model because the water or the Marlette water system is currently undergoing a rate study, and it's unclear how much their rates will increase. So we were conservative and assumed a 5% rate increase year over year on that system, which would be more expensive for the Carson City system. So in general, these are the assumptions we used. One item I would like to point out is we used a customer growth percentage of 0.7%. The FCS model 2012 assumed 0% growth year over year. It was in the middle of the recession, so I would assume that's why. But we went with a 0.7%. So that's all the economic and financial factors and assumptions used to come up with these results. So starting with the water model, first thing I would like to point out is the water CIP that was established for the next 5 years, which Eddie came up with these numbers. The main items I would like to point out are the water line replacement and rehab program being heavily funded over the next 5 years, and then the Quill treatment plant rehab. You see in 2024, we have a $1 million design cost, and then in 2025, we have a $9 million for construction of Quill treatment plant rehab projects. So those are two big items that influence rates that we will go over shortly. Moving on to the debt services for the next 5 years, I was able to extend the model out past 2025 to 2033 just to get an idea of upcoming debt services corresponding to this CIP, because there is a CIP that actually goes out 20 more years. We were just looking at the 5-year time frame. So as you can see here, in 2020, there's a large retirement of debt, $10 million that is not covered through rates. But after that, new debt is accrued in 2024, 2025 and 2026 to help fund that Quill treatment plant. It's approximately $12.5 million, and those costs are escalated up to 2024 dollars. And then after that, there is a debt retirement in 2027 of existing debt, and then 2028, the model suggests that new debt will need to be acquired. And then again in 2031, existing debt retires. So this is just to give you more of an idea of where the debt services will be over the next few years. In general, the debt remains around 4.8 to all the way up to, well, I guess the lowest is 3.6 million with a max of 5.8 million in 2027. Mostly attributable to the Quill treatment plant. So with the CIP and these debt services, we can go on to the rate model results. The model suggests that a 3% increase across the board to every customer for every year for the next 5 years, starting July 1st, 2020. Oh, that should say 2020. Sorry, that should say 2020, so make a note there. It would bring in the proper amount of revenue to meet the annual expenditures, and we do meet our days of O&M goal between 60 and 90 days. The dip down in 2022 and 2023 are leading up to the Quill treatment plant payments that will begin 2024 and 2025. So in general, it shows good results, and this is actually really great news, especially considering that no rate increases have taken place over the past 2.5 years. So the FCS 2012 model with their steep rate increase suggestions really got the utility to a good place. So moving on to the operating and capital funds under this 3% increase for the next 5 years. As you can see in these charts, the operating fund is meeting its goals of target balance, between 60 and 90 days of operating cash on hand. And then the capital fund, as mentioned earlier, we tried to keep the capital fund as close to the minimum target balance in order to allow funding for capital projects without having to sell bonds. So in general, any funding that is above the minimum target is available for capital projects, which is a healthy place to be. So with the 3% rate increases proposed across the board over the next 5 years, these are what your rates will be for each rate class. One thing I wanted to point out is that the rate classes in water increase by meter size. So I only showed the 5/8 inch meter and the 1 inch meter here, but those are applicable. Those flat rates are applicable for both the residential and commercial class. It'll just change depending on their meter size. And then the residential has a tiered volume charge between certain amounts of gallons consumption. And then the multifamily, commercial, and large commercial all have volume charges per 1,000 gallons. And this is the existing rate structure. It's just with 3% increases proposed each year.
It could also be July 1, 2020
at the top. Yes, that carries across the board. That had to do with the error of the January and July, but we are proposing rate increases for July 1, 2020. So those are the water results. If anyone has any questions and would like to talk about that at all before we move on to wastewater?
I think we do. Bruce? Okay.
Yeah, I just want to make sure I understand on the page with regard to how you reference on page 26. For example, we have new or retired bond, and you say retires. I'm not sure how to interpret that. I see, obviously, we're retiring $15 million of debt service there, but we still have $4 million left. So
yes.
How do I understand that, or what is it?
So the top row says existing debt service payment. When an existing debt or bond that you have out retires, then that amount is subtracted from the existing debt service. The next row down that says new debt service are results of the model suggesting that bonds will need to be sold to cover the capital account. So I interpreted that as new debt service. And then the total estimated debt service is the sum of the existing plus the new in that last row there. Does that make sense? Or
it does, but what does the word retires tell me?
That one of the existing bonds...
One of the bonds is paid off.
Yes.
In effect. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, and I guess that I have other questions overall, but that's fine for now. Thank you.
Okay.
Anybody else? Bob?
Thank you. Alexa, on, I think it was slide 8, on system reinvestment funding.
Yes.
And this is, what are the depreciable lives of the assets for Carson City Water?
That varies by the asset. We're allowed to go up to 50 years on things like concrete, things that are going to last a long time, certain types of pipe. Their lifespan is likely much higher, like a PVC pipe could be 100 years plus, but we're allowed to depreciate up to 50 years. Things like a pump or a motor, something like that, can be in that 5 to 20 year, depending on its use.
Thank you. And has Carson City looked at the whether have those been revisited recently, or are you pretty comfortable with where we're at there as far as assumed life of the infrastructure?
Yeah, those get revisited every financial audit, actually. We did have that number. You can see it jumps on the wastewater side from 2018 to 2019. That was the treatment plant, the wharf, and the improvements we did there. We had a fairly significant change with that number. The initial take was those recent improvements were on a 50-year life. And as we dug more into that, the pumps and things like that got pushed closer to that 10 to 20 year, depending on the item. So it moved that number up more.
And, one further question, Alexa, on that cap on connection fees of 3%, it's some type of index or CCI?
Yes, so the ENR CCI is the engineering news and news records construction cost index, and it varies year to year depending on how much it costs to construct water lines, etc., construction costs. But according to the ordinance, they have a cap of a 3% increase on connection fees, regardless of what the ENR CCI says that year. So if it says 5 years, they can only 5%. Increase, or 5%, they can only increase it by 3% because that's the cap on the ordinance.
And has that cap come into play? And I guess the reason I'm asking, if we're looking at 3% increases on the water rates, is there some assurance that the connection rates are going to go up by at least that amount every year, or no?
No.
That number fluctuates. I think, I'm trying to think over the past decade, if it's gone higher than 3%, it may have. We looked at that in Sparks, right?
Yeah, when we did the study in Sparks, when I was there, we looked at it from 2000 forward, and it had averaged right about the 2.5% we're using in this study. During the recession, there was a few years where it went -6%, -8%, and then there was a year or two as the nation came out of that, where I think we hit 13% one year. And that is a national average. They look at 20 cities and look at a certain amount of board feet of lumber, certain tons of steel, things like that, the various components that would go into a construction project is how they determine that number.
And I guess, but I guess the, so I understand that there's no intent to keep the revenue split, if you will, between users and connection fees in some, in the same proportion to each other over the 5-year rate period.
Yeah, that if it only went up 2%, the connection fee would only go up 2%, yet the user rate would be 3. Is that what you're saying?
Right.
Yeah. No, we were just looking at a straight 3% on the user fees.
Thank you.
I just do think it, for the record, bears clarifying that to date, we have not used the ENR CCI because the adopted rates, they were put in later than the water and wastewater rates. The connection fees were put in later. So the last increase is effective 7/1 of 2020. So it would be after that we would increase those based on the CCI, the indexing. We're still in the middle of that increase, that ramp up increase of those rates. We haven't even completed it from the first study we did. So we chose this time not to go back and revisit connection fees because we're still in the ramp up of those original rates that were adopted from before. So we would, you know, certainly take feedback, but maybe 2 or 3 years from now, we could go back and revisit the connection fees again and see if we're where we should be hitting our targets, that sort of thing. But as of today, we're still in that ramp up period of charging the appropriate rate for the connection fee. We haven't even maxed that out yet. So before once that happens, then we would start the indexing.
Thank you.
Bruce, did you have something you wanted to add?
No.
Yeah, oh, sorry. Randy, go for it.
So the 3% increase annually is an estimate at this point, or is that what's being proposed in the basis of that proposition?
That's what's being proposed.
And the basis of it is?
To meet the annual expenditures and get within the days of O&M goals, essentially to meet all those goals that we listed at the beginning of the presentation.
So the 3% is the result of an analysis mm-hmm. that's taken place?
Yes.
It's not picked out of the air and then other?
No. Okay. It's what the model proposed as the rate increase, 3% for the next 5 years.
But the model does the analysis?
Yes.
I just want to make sure that there's some basis for the 3%.
Oh, yes. We updated the model with all the recent financials, all the asset information, the CIP, the existing debt, et cetera, and the model proposed the 3% increase.
Okay. I would like some clarification. This goes back to the background
sure.
slide. Again, when I was reviewing this, there was some information that that's like a back one. This one. The wastewater rate was a 15% yearly increase?
Yes. Up until 2018.
15% per year?
Yes.
It's quite a hole.
Right. But remember, depreciation was being funded 0% at the beginning of that study, and now it's up to 80%, which is very admirable for a utility to get to that.
So if we go to the next slide, and we see the wastewater connection fee, over 1 year it goes from $3,710 to $4,493. That connection fee based on a 3% cap?
No.
No.
That's like a 20% increase. I'm not seeing where that comes from.
Yeah, that was the previous.
So
if you want to touch on that, Darren.
Randy, if you remember when we did the analysis the first time and FCS presented the rates for water and wastewater, and then they presented what the connection fee should be, the board, not this group, but the Board of Supervisors adopted the water rates and the wastewater rates, but they did not want to raise the connection fees because they didn't want to slow down any growth that wasn't happening in the city at the time. So then it wasn't until 2.5 years later that, under direction from this committee, staff brought back those connection fees and that discussion again. And we held that here, and then we took that to the Board of Supervisors, and ultimately the Board of Supervisors then adopted the increase of the connection fees that were currently at $500 each. And they said, okay, let's get those to where they should be, but we're going to phase them in over 5 years. The last year of that phase-in is this July. So this number that you see here, that's 20% because that's a 5-year phase-in. After we phase in this July, then we go to the indexing of those rates from there on out. That's independent of the water and the wastewater monthly fees that we're talking about.
Okay, thank you for that clarification, because that was pretty much what my recollection was, but I didn't get that from the slide, so it was my misinterpretation of the slide. I do have other questions, but I'll save them until later.
Okay.
Any other discussion? Bruce, no? All right.
Okay.
Back to you, Alexa.
Great. Now we'll move on to the wastewater model rate results. Again, starting with the wastewater CIP over the next 5 years, the main items I wanted to point out, similar to the water CIP, is the sewer line replacement and rehab is pretty heavily funded over the next 5 years because aging infrastructure needs to be replaced. And then, as you will see towards the bottom, there are two line items for the WRRF, the water reclamation facility expansion and construction. They're in fiscal years 2029 and fiscal year 2030 right now. It is growth-based, so we'll see how it plays out. But I included them here just to have them on your docket for the next slide, which will review the estimated debt for those two projects. So similar to the water model, the wastewater model is anticipating that starting in 2028 through 2031, approximately $1.8 million of new debt will need to will be taken on by the city to help fund those that expansion project of the plant out there. Other than that, the model is not suggesting other new debt being taken on in the next 5-year time frame, and there's actually an existing debt bond being retired in 2025. So, similar to the water model, the wastewater model also suggested that a 3% increase across the board to every customer class over the next 5 years, starting July 1, 2020, will be sufficient to cover annual expenditures over the next 5 years and gets us within our days of O&M of operating cash between 30 and 45 days for the wastewater system. Looking at the operating and capital fund, as I just mentioned, the operating fund is within the 30 to 45 days. And any excess cash from the operating fund gets transferred to the capital fund per the FCS assumptions we discussed earlier, leading to a surplus in the capital fund. But as you can see in that capital fund chart, we added a couple lines, one that shows you the annual CIP every year, and the purple one that shows the system reinvestment funding goals for the wastewater system. So this surplus in the capital fund actually just helps us meet those goals and then is also available to help fund that plant upgrade that's anticipated in 2029. So that's the reason for a little bit of surplus in the capital account. This 3% rate increase across the board in July 1, 2020 results in the rates shown here. The current rate structure is the same as it currently is, or this rate structure is the same as the current structure, in which there are flat rates for the single family residential and the multifamily, and then the commercial accounts are split into low strength waste commercial accounts and high strength waste commercial accounts, where they have a base charge and a volume charge per 1,000 gallons. And these rates are just increased 3% every year. So, to summarize the final findings, we put together a rate comparison slide. It does say water rates at the top, but it's actually water and wastewater combined. So these are the water rates shown here are for the smallest residential meter size in that area, and it assumes 12 kilogallons of consumption because Eddie ran some calculations and found that that was about the average consumption experienced in Carson City. All rates shown here are effective July 1st, 2020, except for Tumwa, Fallon, and Douglas County. In addition to that, as you'll see on the far right, we've put in Carson City's fiscal year 25 proposed rate. And in general, this slide just helps show that Carson City is in a healthy situation compared regionally, and just wanted to point that out. A couple notes is that there are some within these agencies, there are a few that are undergoing their own rate studies and five-year increases, including Dayton and Mount House, Virginia City, and Sparks. So just pointing these out to show that Carson City is in a good place. And that concludes our presentation. I'll take any questions now.
Yeah, do you want to follow up with anything or bring it back to the committee?
Yeah, no, it's been a fun process for Far West. They've put a lot of effort into understanding our current model and all the various little nuances in there. And I think they've done a really good job of, you know, cleaning up any little issues we had, making it run right, and, you know, after sitting there for 5 years. And we're pretty happy with what they've come up with.
Thank you, Andy. So my understanding is staff is looking for recommendation from UFOC that then you can forward on to the Board of Supervisors. Can you maybe relay a timing? If we're looking to be effective July 1.
Yeah. If you have some thoughts, Darren.
Yeah, then we would need that recommendation about a month ago. it's very tight. Like Alexa said and Andy said, it's you really do want to do rates based on the fiscal year because that's how the budgets are set up. So you do everything in your power to try and do rates that way. Having said that, we do understand that it doesn't always pencil out and make it work that way, and there's other competing factors that doesn't allow that. So we as Public Works, we will, you know, ultimately, whenever it gets decided, or if it gets decided that there would be a rate increase and they give us a time frame, we would then go back to the model. If it's not July 1, plug that time frame into the model and see, you know, what it spits out in terms of what comes out of that. So, but our next steps are then, once this board is happy and satisfied and wants to make a recommendation forward, we would bring an item to the Board of Supervisors for their consideration. Depending on how that looks, then the next step is to do the business impact studies and the two readings, and then after that, put the rates into effect. So that's kind of how it spells out, but we're more interested in, you know, what you think of what's going on over here, and we'll work the time frame out once we get to the next step.
All right. Thank you for that, Darren and Andy. So with that, I'll bring it back to the committee for any thoughts, any modifications, whatever your pleasure is. Bruce, you want to go first?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just some observations and I guess some thoughts. When the FCS changes were imposed several years ago, there was quite a hole and quite a deficit that had to be overcome. And it created a lot of difficulty and angst for our customers because the multiple 5 years of increase, of significant increases, was really substantial. I know folks are really concerned about water and sewer rates, but I think the concept of a smaller increase on a program basis makes a lot of sense in trying to give our customers the best possible way of trying to address and adjust to what are ongoing expenses and ongoing increases in expenses. And Carson City's had quite a bit of catch-up, a lot in the sewer and some in the water in terms of capital improvements. And you can begin to see some of the benefits of what's happened over the last few years. There's only one big major capital improvement in the water system, and that's the treatment plant at Quill. And that's not because the city wants to do that. That's because of water quality demands and other issues that are regulatory types of things. So I feel that this kind of an approach is valuable. It's just like we talked about a few minutes ago with the connection fees that got postponed 6 or 7 years ago. I think if we don't recommend to the Board of Supervisors a progressive, small step in approach like this, then we simply leave them in a position of coasting for another year and not really doing the utilities or the ratepayers in the long term, a good deed. I am concerned that we still don't make it quite with the sewer at 3%. I really wonder, for example, what 3.5% would do on the sewer side. I think there's potential there to get us, and I guess the way I view our role is to try to recommend to the Board of Supervisors what we feel is a sustainable approach in this process. It's a rate increase. There's no way to hide it, but that's what it is, and I think it's a lot better than, 10 or 15 or 20% a year for multiple years, 3 years down the road. The board has been very open, I think, and very willing to consider recommendations that we've made. They did go forward with the fee increase on the connection fees over a progressive kind of a window, as Darren outlined. And I think they understand the situation, and I think we can give them some good recommendations. I would throw out for discussion the possibility of having the rates after 2025 or 2026 indexed as well, so that you don't have to go through rate refreshes or rate studies on an ongoing basis unless things get to be completely out of whack. And with the way the capital budgets are, as we look at them for both wastewater and water, and the way we are currently with our financial situation, in terms of debt and in terms of the cost of borrowing, that might be a way to help set the city up for a sustainable level of rates. We could do it similarly to the way the connection fee is, where it would not exceed a certain number, a certain percentage. But that if the in that case the Engineering News Record Construction Index was more than 3%, it would stop at 3. If it was less than 3, then it wouldn't go to 3. But I'd like to throw those things out for discussion and some at least something for us to talk about. Thank you.
That's a great start, Bruce. You hit two of the items that I had circled, but I'll hold my thoughts for the end. Bob, you want to take a stab?
No, I have it. Thank you, Chair. I have the same thought of indexing, but I just had the 3%. And I don't know how this model works, but I I'm used to seeing, okay, what does it look like at 2.5%? What does it look like at 3%? What does it look like at 3.5% in some of these financial metrics? And I guess my question is does the model, does 3% sort of put you where you want to be in year 3 and a little better than where you want to be and need to be in year 5 and start out behind year 1? Or do you sort of maintain, is it sort of keeping up with escalating costs over the 5 years? I generally like the idea of not revisiting this every year, but those are my thoughts. Thank you, Chair.
Well, if I may add my my understanding of it, and then staff can correct me if I'm wrong, but by and large in the water fund, we have been hitting our goals with regards to the financial policies. We've been meeting those. So my understanding is this 3% increase would be to keep us in within the lines, if you will, of meeting those policies. Is that an accurate statement?
Yeah, exactly.
So what happened is when you kick off this model, you have to put the inputs in there. And that sheet that showed all of those assumptions, so we got more accurate numbers in terms of if you go down that list, in terms of things that are going to increase in cost over the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. So those are inputs that we put into the model. And then the other thing you put into the model is an updated CIP. So when we did it before in 2012, of course, we had a 5-year CIP. But that model did not look at years 6 through 10. It just looked at the next 5 years. This model, we took years 6 through 10, now currently 1 through 5, put that data in the model. So once you input all of those things and the costs over the next five years, that's employment costs, benefit costs, all of those things, you plug those in. The model computes it and spits out a number, and that's what it said. If you want to do this capital plan and these inputs that you have in terms of costs of labor, costs of equipment, all of that you need to raise your rates 3% a year to keep that. And by doing that, then we meet all of those financial requirements that we put on when we did this back in 2012. So that's kind of a 30,000 foot level of how this came about. We didn't choose the 3% and then the model pick out everything else. We inputted all that other stuff and the model came out with 3%, which is very interesting that it settles in on that number, because the you know, if you look at inflation or indexing, it's 2.5-3% over the past years. The model is basically telling us what we already knew, that in general, costs of things, you know, they inch up a little bit each year. And that's what the model tells us is going on here. That's why it really wasn't a big surprise to us. What it does mean is that when it was put together in 2012, that the assumptions, the way it was built, and that was a very tough thing to swallow in terms of what it was recommending. But by doing that, as Alexa stated early on, it set us up to where we are now, where it's healthy. Now you're just doing maintenance moving forward.
Yeah, I think we're at the point now, it's the cost of doing business, right? This is the cost of operating our fund. We're not trying to dig out of a hole anymore.
A couple of minor questions. I think is the 3%, it seems like from the first 5 years, in moving into the second 5 years, the 3% projection has been validated. It's a solid projection. If, as we get into the next 5 years, if it turns out that we don't have the revenue coming in to support capital projects, then the way to address that, and I'm asking this, is to delay projects that are in the CIP?
Yeah, that would be for the first. And some of that, like our need for the expansion at the wharf, if, you know, our growth factors aren't hitting what they are, or growth slows down, that's going to push the need for that project off.
Okay.
But that I do. You're spot on with that capital plan is, you know, these are numbers in a spreadsheet. But every year when we do our budget and we bring our budget here, we make our capital plan fit whatever number is in that budget for that year. And it's not the number on this sheet now. This is just an estimate. We get the number from finance of what is available, and then we tweak our capital plan for that one year to fit within that. Sometimes it's a little more, sometimes it's a little less, but that's what we have to build on. These are just the estimates of what that would be.
Okay, one other question about the presentation, the economic and financial factors. There's a number of different line items with annual increases. Are those annual increases applied to that relevant line item in the budget or the projection? For example, labor cost inflation, that factoring up is utilized only against labor costs, correct?
Yes. So what it does, what we put into the model is the approved fiscal year 2020 budget for that line item, and then it projects it forward over the next 5 years based off these percentages.
Okay.
And as you can see, we were consistent from 21 to 25. The labor cost inflation one in particular, though, in the sewer model, Andy had an idea of in a couple years from now, he will probably hire someone in addition to his existing crew. So we added an estimation of how much that expenditure will be at that time it on top of that 4% increase, just particular to that year.
So. Okay. I can only imagine the spreadsheet that you have.
It's a beast.
You probably have a radiator on your computer when you run it. The other comment is the graphs that you show in your slides.
Yes.
And the target ranges. My compliments. I think they really graphically present a lot of the narrative that we have to look at, and that really provides a good explanation and a good description of the trending of it.
Thank you.
So my compliments.
Good, Bob.
Yeah. Thank you, Chairman. Yeah, I had one more thought just on that. I guess it's slide 9 on the economic and financial factors that Rand, you're just asking about, that I see that benefits cost inflation of 10%. Was that there from 2015 to 2020?
No.
And is that, but that's per the city. That's what the city's.
Yes. So what we did, I know 10% seems high. What we did was we took the past 5 years and took an average of that, and it varied significantly from year to year. I think at one point it was like a 33% increase. And that was actually all of us as a team looked at it together and settled on 10% being appropriate. However, that should be monitored because it varies so greatly from year to year.
That's essentially doubling your benefits every 7 years cost.
Yeah.
Quadrupling them every 14 years. That just sounds really high to me.
Yeah.
Finance isn't here. They could explain it, but it's a big part of that is healthcare.
Sure.
A big part of that is healthcare. And it's been, like she said, 1 year, 33% increase. And I certainly don't understand all that, but that's where we got the number from.
Wow. Well, thanks, Bob. Bruce teed up a couple of the issues that I had on my plate. The first one I was going to, if you flip to the slide right prior to this. The system reinvestment in the water, the goal through the FCS study was to achieve 100% reinvestment funding at the end of the current cycle, I guess. And your presentation proposes that we maintain that 100%, which is the right thing to do. And it meets the city's financial goals. The wastewater through the FCS study, because it was such a large gap between where we were at and where we needed to be, that study only was able to get us to an 80% increase, or an 80% of system reinvestment, I should say. One of the things that I'm noting, and it's small, I recognize,
But even at the end of this next proposed five-year phase-in, we're still not achieving 100% reinvestment funding. The model, you know, proposes up to a 95%, and I would offer, I'd like to see us just bite the bullet and get to the 100%. I think the difference between 95 and 100 is probably the difference between a 3% and perhaps a 3.1% increase or something relatively small along those lines. But that would be my two cents. I would like to see us getting to full system reinvestment. The other point that Bruce brought up was in indexing. And when I first got the packet, that was what I was in favor of. And over the last couple of days, I've been thinking about it. And while I'm still a proponent of indexing in general, I'm a little concerned that what it does is it tries to put us in a situation where we put the utility funds on autopilot. And from a rate standpoint, I don't think that's appropriate. I think if we're looking at a political environment 5 years, 5 to 10 years from now, where we think refreshes or studies are going to be difficult to do, then perhaps indexing now is an appropriate mechanism to deal with that. But the reality is, I think we should be revisiting these on a regular basis, and it's not an autopilot exercise. So I'm not opposed to indexing, but if we did it, I think we'd want to. I don't know if the engineering ENR CCI is appropriate because it's construction. I don't know if the consumer, the CPI is appropriate because it's based on other things, so maybe there's some sort of composite. But in general, I think I would be an advocate of just creating an underwritten policy, if you will, where we're constantly going in and looking at the current rate structure. So that's my two cents. I'll bring it back to committee if you want to make one more round. Bruce?
Yeah, just briefly, I think it's important that we remember to look carefully at the costs. You know, we're talking on the revenue side, but 10% on benefits and 4% on salaries are both higher than any other assumptions that we're using. And so encouraging on an ongoing basis anything we can do to reduce the cost of salaries. And I don't mean in terms of, you know, cutting salaries or anything like that. I think investigating the potential of having a solid, experienced, well-compensated management core with potentially other places where instead of adding a new person on the sewer crew or a new person on the water crew, maybe there's a way to look at part-time, maybe there's a way to look at temporary, maybe there are other ways that would reduce the cost of overhead associated with those city salaries. As an analogy, at the senior center where I'm involved on the governing board, there's no way we could afford to operate that center with all city employees. It's just too expensive. And we happen to have there a lot of seniors who want to work part-time or want to do things, so it's not completely analogous. But the idea of let's not go to what Mike refers to as autopilot, because I think the tendency there is just to continue to increase and this is what it is. I think we really owe the ratepayers the ongoing management, if you will, of cost increases and particularly of salary costs.
Well said. Thank you, Bruce. Any other comments? If none, I will open up to public comment. Do we have any public comment on this item? Seeing none, bring it back to the committee for a motion.
Why not, right?
Go for it, Bruce.
I would move that we go along or we approve and recommend the staff's recommendation with respect to the water system funding and that we ask the staff to recalculate and slightly increase the wastewater funding to get us to the point of reinvestment meeting 100% within the next 2 to 3 year period. And that probably represents 3.1, 3.2, 3.3%, so that we do meet all the standards that this committee, with advice and with input, has recommended and the Board of Supervisors, I think, have approved in terms of concept. I'd just like to see us get there sooner. Thank you.
I have a motion. Is the direction clear? Okay. Can I get a second?
I don't know what the motion was.
I'll second the motion.
I have a motion.
Do I need to explain? It's the staff recommendation for water. It's the staff recommendations for sewer modified slightly so that we meet the capital, the system reinvestment strategy of 100% in the next 2 to 3 years rather than not meeting it in 2025.
But we wouldn't know what that rate is, correct?
The motion is that the staff recalculate and that become the basis for our recommendation going forward. And I think it's going to be a relatively small increment above the 3%.
Alexa and Brent, I hate to put you on the spot, but are we near close in the ballpark numbers we're throwing out up here?
We did, kind of anticipating that 95% number being a sticking point, look at going to 100% in 2025.
Yes.
You have that at the end,
the
correct?
First extra slide.
Okay.
So we're ahead of the game, you guys.
So at 2025, going to that, if you want to talk to that, it basically pushes our target down just a little in that last year. In 2025?
Right. So we're still within the range of days in O&M on hand. The main item I wanted to point out is right here. This is a summary of the cash flows, the first chart being system reinvestment up to 95% in 2025, and then the second chart is 100% by 2025. I highlighted the two cells that are different. So this is our net cash flow after the 3% rate increase. I did not run other scenarios. I just ran the 3%. So we would, by the end of 2025, have a small negative cash flow in 2025. I did run, so like I mentioned earlier, I was able to extend the model past 2025. Although I will quickly say that the SES model isn't meant to go that far. So I looked through everything and tried to catch any possible error, but there could be some small error at some point just because it wasn't created to go that far. What I found out from that analysis is that years assuming a 3% increase every single year for the next 10 years, by 2026, we would be back to a positive cash flow of $150,000. By 2027, we would be at a positive cash flow of $327,000. 2028 is $468,000. 2029 is $527,000 positive cash flow. But then in 2030, we go negative again, because of the wharf upgrade. A 3% rate increase at those times may not be sufficient. But as I said earlier, this model is not supposed to go out that far, so I can't say with full confidence that those are accurate numbers. But the main thing I wanted to get to is that if we raise rates by 3% over the next 5 years, and do the 100% system reinvestment, and we have negative cash flow by 2025, if there isn't some sort of index or ordinance, et cetera, that keeps rates increasing 2026, 2027, 2028, it is likely that the sewer fund could be in a bad situation with its cash flows. And I only say that because, I mean, right here as we stand right now, the rates haven't been increased in 2.5 years. We were just very fortunate that the SES model recommended such steep increases to get us to a healthy point right now. But keeping at a low rate increase over the next 5 years, if you stop and don't do any more rate increases and you're funding system reinvestment 100%, there is a chance that you could quickly get back into that situation where you need 10% increases or so if you don't keep it consistent. increasing in general.
Thank you for that. Andy, if you could flip back a slide or two. What I'm hearing you say, keep going one more, right there. So, and maybe it's a small, it looks like it is a smaller. What I'm hearing from you is we can meet 100% system reinvestment funding with a 3% increase, but what I'm seeing is we're taking it out of days of O&M.
Yes.
What happens on 2026? Does that tick back up to 45 days O&M and we're still at 100%? Because I heard you say we're positive cash flow again.
You are positive cash flow. I'm not sure if I have days of O&M on this.
Well, the reason why I'm bringing it up, because I think what Bruce's motion was, is we don't just look at a 3%, because you keep all the metrics that you presented in your earlier presentation, you keep all those as is. We tweak the rate structure in a manner that we can get to 100% system reinvestment funding. I guess there's two ways to do it. One, we're clearly meeting our upper limits on all of our policy. We cannot meet our upper limit of our policy. And that way we're meeting the 100% guideline. I guess, Bruce, it's up to...
To go back to what you were proposing or talking about otherwise, which we don't have an answer today.
Right.
But if you took wastewater to 3.5%, for the next 5 years instead of 3%, you know, there's enough of a thumbnail here to know that would in fact solve the deficit, you know, going forward. So it's going to be somewhere in that range between 3% and 3.5%, the same for the next 5 years would solve that anomaly. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Yeah.
And we could run that scenario quickly.
Obviously it's not going to happen today for this meeting, but I think, Bruce, I'm just restating your point, I guess. You're looking to get to 100% reinvestment at a certain time period, and if you have to adjust that increase by whatever metric between 3 and 3.5% is what Darren is suggesting, is that kind of meet your need, your goal?
Yes, it is. And just to put into context, the 2021 rate's at $41.66 per single-family resident. The difference between 3% and 3.5% is about 25 cents a month. So it's not a huge number, but it potentially puts us where we want to be with regard to the metrics. And I like the idea of being able to tell the board, we think this gets us to the ability, based on the projections, to meet 100% of the guidelines that have been recommended by this committee, based on input we've had and adopted by the board as goals. So short answer to your question is yes.
Thank you, Bruce. So I have a motion by Member Scott. I have a second by Member Johnson. Randy, did that answer your questions?
It did. From the standpoint of discussion, would we accomplish the same thing by going with a 3% as proposed, 3% on the water and 3.5% on the wastewater? Would that accomplish what?
Sure.
And staff says staff's estimate is 3.5 on wastewater, 3.5% increase annually would get us to our goal for system reinvestment.
Well, I don't think staff has gotten there. I think what we're saying is we would like them to go back to the Board of Supervisors with a recommendation to fund depreciation at 100% in the next 2 to 3 years. And that's likely going to increase that rate increase between 0 and 0.5%. Okay. All right. We're all clear. Thank you, everybody, for indulging me on that. So with that, I got a motion and a second. I'll take a vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, unanimous 4-0. So that takes us to item number 2B, discussion and possible action to the recommend to the Board of Supervisors a stormwater rate structure and rate increase that will generate additional revenue up to an additional $1.4 million to support an improved citywide stormwater program. Who's taking, is this you, Andy, or is this?
Start this one again. Again, for the record, Andy Hummel, wastewater utility manager for Carson City. So this item today, the stormwater utility rate adjustments, is based on comments received in our last meeting in November we were asked to take a harder look at two of the options discussed at that time, namely modifying and tweaking the existing rate structure, and then the second one, looking at going to a rate structure that was based on grouping the properties by impervious area. Far West has looked at both of those and ready to show you what those results are. So I'll turn it over to Brent.
Thank you, Brent Farr, for the record here. You know, I have to point out, Alexa comes in here one time and gives her little water and rate presentation she's done. She's back here for the stormwater rates, and hopefully this is closer to what you're hoping to see here today. So, Andy, let's go to that next slide here. Just wanted to review some of the things that some of the direction the board gave at the last, or the committee gave at the last meeting. We've established that a $3.2 million revenue requirement is the goal. And we've also established what the capital improvement program looks like over the next 10 years. And so some of those things I think we've established at this point. The thing that we've been asked to do is to come back with a little more information on what was called the grouped impervious method, and then modify existing, which we had previously called tweaked. We just decided to call it something different. You also asked if we could evaluate the concept of mitigation credits for people that have done BMPs or detention basins and things like that. And then there was a couple of you that recommended combining the commercial and manufacturing rate class because there wasn't a lot that distinguished the two of those, and I think that was wise. And to look at potentially indexing rate increases like we've been talking about today, and phasing in the increase and considering low-income assistance. So we're going to talk about some of those things here. Just a refresher on where we stand today on existing rates. Okay, so this is what we had originally called the tweaked method, but it's the modifying the existing rate structure. And so a couple things, I'll just kind of walk through this. For the single family property or the home-based business, we've got a minimum rate of $9.34 a month. And we're not, this method, there's no variation. It's just what every resident would pay the same, $9.34. For the multifamily, though, a new approach, a minimum rate of $9.34. But generally speaking, the commercial or the apartments would be charged on a unit basis at 50% of the single family residential rate, but would be capped at the max commercial rate, which on this slide shows is $200. And so it's a bit of a different approach for them. You know, so for the really large apartment complexes, they're going to pay $4.72 or whatever, or per unit for each apartment, but only up to $200. And that does get them closer to, I think, if you go back one or two, Andy, the existing rates right there. So they're currently paying, $29.33 for even a 300-unit apartment complex. And now they'd be paying, the really large ones would be paying $200 a month. But it does create quite a bit more equity there. Then we've got the agricultural, the open space and public property category paying $52.56, which is just the existing rate times an increase of what would be required if we had left all the rates the same. So what was the original rate there, Andy, for the ag? That was a 3203, so a bit of an increase there. But I think all the rates would have to go up by, I think it was 60% or something like that, 64. And then when we get to the commercial and manufacturing property, this would be tiered by parcel size, with a minimum rate of $30 going up to $200. And that first bullet kind of shows the different property sizes. You've got a quarter acre paying the $30, between a quarter acre and an acre, $60, and so on. You can see how that breaks out there. So, you know, the original concept here was to take the existing rate structure and just modify it a little bit to try to find a little bit more equity maybe between, you know, smaller properties and larger properties. And then the multifamily was really getting, I think, quite a break before. And so this kind of gets them paying a little bit more their fair share. I'm just looking at that last bullet there, in keeping with the recommendation about low-income assistance, providing funding to FISH to offer low-income assistance. So that's, now Andy, you kind of helped on that. You have a thought on how that funding would be?
Yeah, we ran some kind of back of the napkin, calcs, Darren and I did,
okay.
Approximately 20,000 in funding would cover essentially that low income side is what we backed into.
We'd build that $20,000 a year into the rate model such that every year the stormwater fund could contribute up to $20,000 to that to be used for low income assistance. And then through FISH, there would be encouraging of donations from the public if you want to round up your bill or if you want to give so much money to that fund to help in addition to that amount of money was the goal.
Don't we have a similar program in one or two of the other utility funds?
We do. Water and wastewater has a fund similar to that. The only difference is that those two funds do not contribute any money to that program.
Okay, let's go to that next slide, Andy.
One thing to point out as well, that second to last bullet, the residential usage and commercial zoning, paying the single family rate. We have parcels across the city that are commercial zoning, but it's, you know, somebody's basically living there and that's what it is, you know, blocks that are, everything's commercial. The assessor does distinguish that usage, whether it's being used as commercial or residential in their database. So it would basically be using that database to pick those ones that are being used as residential. So then if they do come back and open a business, then they would transition to that commercial rate at that time. So currently the code is...
That's the RC, residential commercial.
Yeah, yep. So currently the code is if you're commercial, you're commercial, doesn't matter what that usage is.
Okay. This is, I don't know, it's kind of interesting. This is the contributing revenue by customer class after the modifications. Things just change a little bit, really, which means that each customer class is still paying roughly the same proportionate share of the total. I mean, multifamily goes up a little bit, but where you see multifamily is you see that, like, some of the really smaller ones, like the duplexes and stuff, are going to be paying less, and then bigger apartment complexes are paying more, but it still kind of averages out. Okay, next slide. Some of the pros and cons here, we believe that this is more equitable than the existing rate structure, or even the modified existing rate structure that... it's kind of confusing because we had called this one originally the tweaked, and so it's confusing myself here. That does include the feedback that we've received to date. It does because it's a kind of a, we're not going to that full extent of like a true impervious method, then it softens the blow to some of the bigger properties. And also those that are like the open space and those kinds of properties. It does provide the funding for the low-income customers and keeps this relatively easy to administer. There's not a lot to do to put this into place. It's not that difficult. It is a little less detailed than some of the other methods we looked at. Maybe could be argued that it's not as equitable, perhaps. And there are, again, several different types of billing methods included here. You know, like apartments are treated a little differently than others.
Before we move on, can I, in the prose, the third bullet point down, it says, sovereigns below largest employees, but the last portion of that is those who have installed on-site drainage improvements. How does, I didn't see that in the breakdown earlier.
We'll show, I mean, there's a slide at the end that kind of talks about the credit system, if we wanted to go to do that. So I guess it depends on how you decide to move with that credit program. It could offer that.
And the other thing to consider, when you develop a property, anybody that's done land development calculations, things like that, your goal tends to be, on the drainage side, matching that pre-existing condition. So by grouping the properties by parcel size alone, regardless of what those improvements are, you know, commercial is commercial, or, you know, the other ones, but it's basically taking that amount of impervious area out of the calculation. So.
Okay, then the other method, Andy, if we can move, was the grouped impervious area approach, where essentially you're combining properties based on the amount of impervious area and giving them a common rate. So the existing rate structure is shown on the top. The single family properties would just be treated as, in the other method, just a flat rate of $9.34, which is about 64% higher than what it is today. And then this has actually been analyzed here. We have what's called the small non-residential category, which is less than 0.25. And that acres is actually the impervious area, not the parcel size. And then you have parcels that have impervious areas between a quarter acre and an acre, and then the large 1 acre to 5 acres, and very large over 5 acres of impervious area, and then the subsequent charges for those categories. And so, I mean, on this one, you could see commercial and even apartment complexes going a little bit higher. In the other one, they're kind of capped at 200. This one goes to 240. But it does, I think, create just a little bit greater equity here across the board. If you go to the next slide, I think this one's also kind of interesting because it shows kind of where the subsidies lie. And so, just doing some analysis on the impervious area totals, the residential customer class, if you assume they have 3,600 square feet on average of impervious area, they account for about 35% of the total, but provide about 57% of the total revenue. And you'll see on the small end, the same thing with those small parcels. They're 2% of the total impervious area, but 7% of the total revenue. And then when you get to the high side, you can see the opposite, more impervious area and less contribution to total revenues. But that's the only way, for example, on those really large parcels that you're not going to see their rates. If I did another one of these where it came out to be equal, for example, 35% and 35% and so on, and in that last category, the rate came to like $900 and something per month to get to where they're contributing 28% of the revenue. So I think that's kind of what we were hoping to accomplish here by, you know, grouping them together in a way. Next slide. Again, this is a more equitable approach than what we currently have and does, as you've just seen, mitigate some of the impacts to the very large properties. And depending on your, I guess, on your opinion, might be less equitable than the impervious area approach. But I think we've had conversations about how, you know, residential customers sometimes benefit in other ways. You know, the just like, for example, road maintenance and things like that. Because the impervious area of roads and streets is not included in this. It's just parcels. And anyway, I guess you could get into the weeds a lot about who benefits most from the services, I guess. This one is a little more difficult to administer because you do have to, you would have to go through and actually determine the impervious area for every parcel. And what was nice for us is we were able to pull up the old database that I think AMEC did or one of their consultants back in 2000, 2001. And a lot of that data that they did was still available. There was a lot of parcels that weren't. So we kind of took the average and applied it to the rest, and it was the best we could do. But I think if you went forward with this, you'd have to go through and double check all those and make sure they were correct. So, and any time anything changes, you have to do that analysis. So it's a bit more administration. Okay, next slide. So the mitigation credits, looked at this in fair detail. There's actually a lot of information on this available in literature and other states where they look at this. And where I got most of this information actually was from Florida, of all places, because they have a very robust stormwater program statewide there and pretty advanced. And so they've looked in great detail at this mitigation credit concept. So let me just kind of walk through that a little bit. Mitigation credits would apply to parcels that have provided on-site detention facilities. And so they're lessening the impact of stormwater runoff to the system. Given two identically situated parcels, the parcel with on-site stormwater facilities will generate a smaller volume of runoff at a slower rate and or with less pollution than a parcel with no facilities. So that's the basis. The mechanics of calculating a precise amount of credit due each eligible customer must be well-founded on engineering concepts. Most credit structures are relatively simple, with a flat percentage reduction upon proof of the stormwater facility's design, construction, and maintenance. So if there was a parcel that wasn't maintaining their facility, then you'd have to kind of watch that too. A single credit value could be calculated for each stormwater design code that has been effected in the city. So this is kind of interesting. If in, say, 2006, there was some update to the code and people were compliant with that most recent code, then that would equate to a certain credit. And I don't know how many code changes you've had over the years in terms of like detention and that kind of thing, but that might be a somewhat easy way to do it. Haven't researched that yet. Given that large parcels are receiving, this is a question I had, given that the large parcels are receiving a substantial subsidy already, should they also be given credit for on-site detention? Just a question. You know, one parcel relative to another, maybe, but that whole group as a, you know, is already being, you know, fairly heavily subsidized by other customers, so. Andy, next slide. Then, you know, we talked about correlating the rates to CCI and phasing in the structure. I think the thing that we need to do is settle on an approach, and then those sorts of things can be easily calculated depending on what we end up with. But I think those are all very good ideas and feasible. So I think that's it for the presentation on stormwater. I'll take the questions now.
Bruce, you want to lead off?
Thank you. I guess I have a question on the comparison between the two types of approaches. On page 48, at least in mine, it says pros and cons of grouped impervious area. One of the pros is that it softens the blow to the largest properties. But when I look at the grouped impervious area approach for the big properties, the monthly rate is $240. And when I look at the modify existing rate, the upper rate for large properties is $200.
Yeah, I think it depends on what you're comparing it to. I think both of them offer a subsidy to the largest parcels. So, I mean, I think relative to, say, that the true impervious method, where the rate would be, you know, I think we looked at that could be, I think the very highest parcels were almost $2,000 a month. So it's not, maybe not relative one to the other, but just in general, I think both of them have that same characteristic that the largest parcels are, that impact is being softened.
And I think, you know, from my comments last time, I don't have any problem with that, because I think a lot of the larger parcels are either owned by the school district or a public entity, yeah, or they're owned by an entity that's an economic generator for Carson City and should be considered in a more favorable way.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bruce. Do we have any other comments? Randy first.
Thanks, Mike. I want to confirm my understanding of, from our last meeting, we're looking at $3.2 million in revenue as a target, and that's based on an existing revenue coming in at 1.8 and a deficit of 1.4. So combining those two, we're looking at 3.2. Correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. On the modify existing rate structure slide. Before that, there. For the multifamily property, just so that I understand, I think I do, but I want to confirm, by unit at 50% of single family residence capped, and then the minimum rate would be $9.34. Is that based on half of the 934 times two units?
Yeah.
For the smallest multifamily? Okay.
Yeah, that caught me at first. I saw that today. Well, it's got to be two to be
like a duplex. Yeah.
And then on the pros and cons, modifying the existing rate structure. I was like you, Brent. I wasn't quite sure that first bullet there. It's more equitable than the modified existing structure. Seems like that's kind of a circular comparison there.
Yeah. We changed the name, and then it got a little muddled.
Okay.
That one slipped through.
Mm-hmm.
And I think on the next slide where it has grouped impervious area approach, the area designations for small, medium, large, very large, I think that's an important enough point to maybe note in the table that those areas are for impervious surface and not parcel size.
That's absolutely.
And then pros and cons of grouped impervious. Under the cons, the second bullet, difficult to administer. I might be splitting hairs here, but I want to make sure that my understanding is accurate. And administration, I think, is different than setting up the program. I think if you're setting up the program, there's going to be additional work involved. But once it's set up, the actual administration of it from year to year, I don't see where this would be any greater than other methods to administer.
It's possible. I suppose you're right. It's probably not a lot, but I think, you know, any new parcel or a modification of a parcel, you'd have to get your GIS manager to look at it and run a quick calc, you know, okay, to see if something's changed. So it's just a little more.
And just from my perspective, I really like the grouped impervious surface area methodology, in large part because it does incorporate impervious surface as opposed to just zoning or land use. That's all I have, Mike.
Thank you, Randy. Bob?
Thank you, Chair. I'm just refreshing my memory. When was
And I'm sure you've probably covered this before, Brent, but when were these rates last changed?
So we did a one-time rate increase to Stormwater to sell that last series of bonds, approximately a little less than $5 million worth of bonds, and that was done 2.5 years ago. And at that point, we had brought forth a recommendation to change the rates and factor them in over time, and the Board of Supervisors ultimately said, well, we'll approve this one-time rate increase to sell that series of bonds because those projects that we funded with those bonds, we needed to move forward with immediately. So we needed that to happen. But they asked us to go back and look at the methodology of how we charge rates and do that first and then bring the rate increases back based on that methodology. So.
Thank you. And so the city is not looking you're not looking at a proposal similar to water and sewer where you'd have small percentage phased in rate increases over a period of time?
No, we actually are. We had that discussion, or we brought that before, I think at the first meeting maybe, in terms of the total revenue that we were looking for. But until we know which approach we're taking, we couldn't divide up what that rate increase would be. But in general, if we left everything alone as it is now and didn't change the methodology, we were looking at about a 60% increase to our rates in stormwater. So the idea is we would, you know, factor that in probably over a period of years, but it would definitely be more than 3%. It would be a bigger number similar to the first water and wastewater that we did in 2012.
Got it. And one more question, Chair. Yeah, you had a comparison slide as to how Carson City with the proposed sewer water rate stacks up against other local jurisdictions. Is there anything analogous to what Carson City is doing with the stormwater?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. You know, it's all over the board because Carson City is actually, in my opinion, at least in northern Nevada, out in front a little bit with this. I mean, Reno just adopted something recently, and they went with like an impervious area method. But prior to that, most utilities have this buried in their sewer rate, and including Reno until just recently. Sparks has a stormwater program and a stormwater rate, but it is unusual. I think we've mentioned it here before that it's based on how much water the customer uses, so it's kind of different. But, you know, as far as stormwater rates go around here, you're kind of a pioneer.
And I would just, you know, offer not a question really, but it's just, when I first saw this on my bill, I said, what is this? You know, I mean, I can see the logic of it in that it is a utility provided and their crews that have to monitor this and see where improvements need to be made. But candidly, you know, I my own opinion is that this is something that should be paid, more equitably be paid for through property taxes. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, there's not that same correlation between I'm using water every month, I'm, you know, putting waste down into the sewer system. It's a real disconnect there for people. And I'd be terrified of doing this in one jump, and I'm glad to hear that that's not the intent, because I think my sense is there's a disconnect when people see this on their bills, because there's not that direct relationship between what you're doing on your property and your house and what this is paying for. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. If there's no more discussion at the committee, then I'll go to public comment. Seeing none, public comment.
Hello, Mark Kornick, Director of Operations for the School District, for the record. I appreciate the analysis here today and the information that's going on. Your water portion was very interesting, and it's a high cost to the school district, but I know it's needed for the water. stormwater, you know, I'd encourage the grouped impervious method because I know, well, first of all, I'm going to double my cost no matter what. But with the group, it's even going to be more than that. But, you know, we're an organization that doesn't have an opportunity to generate revenue. And we're a service to the community. And, in fact, our revenue that we get from the state continues to go down. And so operating costs going up doesn't help any of our students or any of our operations. So it's difficult to manage. Being probably the most efficient school district in the state of Nevada, it's pretty hard to wring anything else out of our utilities and savings. So, again, I'd encourage the impervious area method, and we would support that and do our share. We do have some of the largest properties. In fact, one of our properties is in your pamphlet. And we do have a river of water that pours through our campus, which isn't just our water, it's the water from all over town. And that has flooded several times and destroyed part of our property several times. So I would just ask you to keep that in mind. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other public comment? Seeing none, I'll close public comment and bring it back to the committee. So staff is looking for a recommendation to move forward to the Board of Supervisors on a preferred approach. If there's any other tweaks to that approach that are wanted, please voice them now. Otherwise, let's get it rolling. Bruce?
If I can ask staff, have you had any more feedback? And could you kind of summarize the feedback you had that we talked a little bit about last time, just so we're because I think some people may have commented before and not come today.
Yeah, we haven't really received any new feedback since the last meeting. Feedback has largely been around if we do go to improve an impervious, some way to get credit for on-site detention, things like that. the concept of doing impervious area just on a per square foot basis at the same cost, whether it's a small property or, you know, a Walmart or one of those, you know, that wasn't popular just of that linear relationship just gets really expensive on the bigger properties. Yeah, as far as anything new, like I said, we haven't heard anything else.
I guess we do have some new recommendations along the lines of some of the comments from last time. So thanks, Andy.
Thanks, Bruce. Any other thoughts? Andy, none? A phase-in has been talked about a few times. We haven't really landed on a phase-in. Did your rate structure anticipate a phase in over time? Because I assume the further we go by not meeting our financial policies, the further we go into the hole, so to speak. Is there any way to reconcile that?
It's a great question. I mean, the reality is we're operating in a fairly large deficit relative to where the program should be. So a phase in just, you know, prolongs that. And I don't personally have a solution for that. I think maybe between the committee and staff, some idea of how much time you wanted to give to get to that $3.2 million target, realizing that that number probably increases every year a little bit. But it is a large jump for some of those properties also.
So the structure presented or the either structure presented does not take into account a phase-in period?
No, those are just, yeah, those are the where we need to get. And then once we kind of pick a method, we can look at doing something, say, over 3 years and trying to figure out what that would look like and what staff can live with in terms of how long to get there.
And if you prefer that, we can come back here. You know, if you choose a method, then we could go and crunch the numbers based off of that method and then bring it back here so that you could actually see how each each rate payer is affected, and then potentially how that could be phased in, you know, over time. So that's an option that we could make today. Again, we're not up against a wall here timing wise. The sooner the better, obviously, but there's no hard date, so we want you to be comfortable.
Okay, thank you for that. Between the two different structures, I'm constantly reminded of what got us to this study to begin with, and that was our need to increase revenue in the stormwater fund. And the goal of the Board of Supervisors to develop a structure that's more equitable, quote unquote, than what, I shouldn't say that, I'm not sure if it's a quote or not, but more equitable than what it is today. With that, I kind of tip into the side of wanting to go with a grouped impervious method. There's a little more effort to manage, to not use the administer word, to manage that program perhaps, to get it up and running and to keep it rolling on an ongoing basis. And I also am struck by, I think, the fact that if we do go with a program that looks at a square footage basis, we probably should take into account credits for reducing square footage, which I think is just going to be more overhead to managing that program. And I'll also throw out, I think our stormwater code for a long while now, a decade or more, decade and a half, has required that new development manage their stormwater runoff anyway. So there's a potential that those large generators are going to come in, all those large generators are going to come in looking for a credit that's going to be impactful on the amount of revenue that we can raise. So when I put all of those together, I realize, you know, I kind of swing back to the other side, the modified existing. As much as I don't want to say it because it goes against the let's get a more equitable approach, although when you look at how the difference before and after, it is taking the burden off the residential rate slightly more, 1% more than the grouped impervious area. And I think there's also an easier defense of not having to go into a program that administers or takes into account stormwater credits. So I guess from my standpoint, I'm on the fence leaning to one side. I'm not really solid in one camp, but I feel like getting into a situation where we're constantly trying to manage an impervious area, manage a credit program, you know, at some point we start adding administrative costs to something that isn't generating a whole lot of revenue to begin with, and we're not doing really what we should be doing. As far as phase-in goes, I think that type of increase warrants a phase-in. I don't know if we need to prolong that that point. I'll let the committee weigh in on that, whether we need to reevaluate one more time with a phase-in approach. But I think it's certainly warranted to go to an increase of 60%. It shouldn't happen in 1 year. So those are my thoughts. Member Scott.
Well, hate to leave you, you know, without some comments. you know, we heard last time, I think, some reasonable comments about people who had made major investments in on-site detention. And I view that situation as, yes, there's a bit of a challenge to identify those and figure out the credit for them. But once that's done, I don't see it as an ongoing expense, particularly at that point. And so my leaning is to go towards that, you know, the modified impervious area with some of the credits as outlined in the proposal. I don't really think that I'm particularly anxious to see another version of this if we can agree on a phase-in period and on a concept in terms of what the exact numbers are. I think the concept's pretty close. The exact numbers are going to be slightly different, but I don't know that that warrants another meeting of this group. I'd be willing to do it if the committee feels that way, but I don't see the need personally. If we can come up with a method and a recommendation to the board for a phase-in period.
Thank you for your thoughts, Bruce. Any other? Bob?
Thank you, Chair. I also like the grouped impervious area approach. Obviously, there's going to be some more setup costs, as has been referenced. I can see that. And, you know, the devil's always in the details, and I'm sure you're going to get complaints from people who have, you know, just over an acre and get kicked up to 120, so those breakpoints are tough. But I think it it makes sense if some of the costs that were if some of the issues we're incurring these costs to address are impacted by the amount of impervious area, which is, you know, obviously true. So that's where I come down on it. As to your comments, Bruce, I guess I would defer to the other board members as to where that line is drawn between what the committee recommends and what the committee defers or recommending on and leaves to the Board of Supervisors.
Thank you.
On a phase in or how it should be structured.
Thank you for that. Any thoughts, Randy?
There's a lot of information here. But of the two methodologies, we've kind of narrowed it down to. I, for one, tend to prefer the grouped impervious surface area, number one, because it's based on impervious surface area as opposed to zoning or land use. Secondly, I think only from the perspective of getting improvements done and curing a lot of the stormwater and flooding problems we have, I'd like to see the full rate be implemented. However, that's looking at only one side of the equation. The other side is people still have to pay for this. So in regard to that, I would lean towards staged implementation or phase down, with perhaps the initial year being no more than 60% of the full rate. And then finally, the mitigation credits. I think Far West's presentation on the mitigation or the credits, the final bullet, I think is very much important. Thanks, Andy, for bringing up the slide. Given that large parcels are receiving a substantial subsidy, should they also be eligible for a credit? I was pushing for a credit, but I overlooked that important element of the large parcels. So if a program doesn't have a mitigation credit included in it, I would still support it.
Well, we got four different opinions up here. pretty close, I think, to one another. We can talk about this some more, or we can look for a motion. I'll open it up for either. Somebody wants to make a motion.
If I can ask a question of Brent on this mitigation number six, I'm not sure exactly what that means. What would be a credit? Some sort of a detention pond on a large parcel?
I think that the credits are typically for detention.
Okay.
If that's what you mean. So if you had a facility that held the water and improved the water quality or, you know, anything related to what the code asks, that would trigger a credit.
Are the credits 100% or are they fraction of the?
Yeah, they're just, you would have to determine a percent and that analysis would have to be done. It wouldn't be 100%. They get a reduction for that.
Yeah, I think it may be unusual, but it would be nice for those properties to be given some benefit for what they had to do to get their building permit, especially because it benefits the city as a whole. So personally, I'm not at all uncomfortable with them getting a credit as a large parcel, because presumably they have a pretty large detention facility or some other kind of mitigation measure that not just benefits them, but potentially benefits others.
If I could ask staff, on if a development comes in, is there anything within the code to require them to not produce or generate more runoff than is currently the case?
Yeah, and that is state law as well. And it is, with detention basins, it's a little somewhat misunderstood. You're retaining that volume so that your peak runoff stays within what it was before, but there's still more overall volume generated.
But there's still a benefit to the system.
Yes.
Well, I'm not to be argumentative. I don't know if there's a benefit. There's no negative impact to the system.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I hate to do this, but from my standpoint, I think if we're getting into a situation where we really are looking at credits, I think we need to understand what that credit program looks like. I think we need to understand what the level of impact is to the overall ability for the program to generate revenue. I expect we're going to be looking at some sort of phase-in period. I think there's too many balls in the air right now for this committee to be able to make a recommendation. That's my two cents.
Well, I think you raised some good points. Maybe the question to staff would be, what would be involved to bring back some of the mitigation credit methodologies or framework so that we could review it at this level and also feel comfortable recommending going forward if that's what we decided.
Yeah, I think it's great. Honestly, I mean, just the fact that we get down to one of the methods that the group really likes, I think that gives us the freedom to then come back and say, here's a concept of a mitigation credit, how it would be calculated, what the percentages are, how it would impact the revenues, and therefore it might actually adjust the rates a little bit to make sure that we have right number of or a right amount of revenue. And then we could also look at, say, a three-year phase-in or whatever direction you might give to show what that would look like as well. And then we've got a pretty solid proposal to move forward to the Board of Supervisors.
I'd be comfortable with that. I think the other thing we have to remember is we are already on record as recommending rate increases in water and sewer. And so the ratepayers are going to see something in July if the board elects to do that. So this coming along is going to add to that, depending on timing, maybe not at the same time, but certainly could be a factor from a property owner's perspective.
Yeah, with that then, if there's no objection from the committee, I'd look for a motion to table this for an upcoming meeting when we can explore looking at the grouped impervious method in more depth.
So moved.
I have a motion. Do I have a second?
Second.
Second. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? 4-0. Well, thank you all for that. I think our last item on the agenda, if I can get back to my agenda, is a manager's report on personnel and projects. Rochambeau over there.
I'll jump in here since Andy's been doing a lot of talking. So Eddie Colliery for the record. I'm going to walk you through how we always do it with staff updates, an update on our current and upcoming CIP capital projects that we've been working on, and then a few miscellaneous projects that I feel are relevant. We had a retirement in the water production side at the staff four level, so that cascaded a couple promotions and then a transfer from distribution to production. So we're currently advertising for a senior water tech in distribution. It's in a fairly new position that we added over the meter department, so it's a really important position. So that's currently being solicited for promotionally. And so we'll see where that goes since that's an internal promotion position. That'll open up another position. So that's currently where we're at on open positions. In other news, under staff, Tom Grundy is now moving into our water operations supervisor position that was vacated by RIT last July. Tom's been working on South Carson Street. He's the engineer on record for that project, so he's been slowly transitioning over to water. And so I've been told he's going to come over this month sometime. So I'm looking forward to having him over, and I know the water system is going to greatly benefit from having him there in that position. So that's exciting for us. Moving on to current and upcoming capital projects, east-west, the transmission main, the 24-inch transmission main, completion is everything's in the ground. Right now we're in testing and quality inspection mode for the project. So that's a big accomplishment. The last phase of it, though, is the booster pump station over by Longview that should be in and installed in February timeframe. So that will complete the whole project, and that will then allow us to move that water up to the Quill finished water tank. So that is good news. And other projects coming up this summer is equipping Well 3. I presented last time on the success of the new Well 3B, we're calling it. And so that will be finishing installing the pump house and the pump and motor and all the equipment and connecting it into the existing building so we can actually use the new well. So that's in design or complete design, and we're looking at the summer for installation. Another big project coming up is Prison Hill Booster Pump Station. That is on the southeast of town serving Desert Mountain and Shadow Hills zones with one booster pump station, eliminating two underground booster pump stations that are difficult to maintain. So that's in store for this summer as well. So that's an exciting upgrade for us. Moving on to just miscellaneous projects. We've completed, with the help of Far West, actually the Quill Water Treatment Preliminary Engineering Report. That's been reviewed and finalized. We are able to use the existing facilities and the existing building, just swapping out the treatment technology. So we remove all of our existing diatomaceous earth filters and put in new package conventional treatment systems. And we'd increase it from its capacity about 4 MGD to 6 MGD. Right now we're only producing about 1.5 MGD given the water quality restrictions. So it's a huge upgrade as far as capacity and getting us towards our meeting our build-out demand and everything, and allowing us to use all of our water that we have there. And some of our cheapest sources are our surface water sources that just come right into the plant from Kings and Ash Creek. So it's a big upgrade. It'll greatly benefit staff on making it more automated and less manually intensive. We also are lucky to have Tumwa installing the same technology on White's Creek. So we've been able to visit with them and visit the site and learn from them doing it already. So that's been exciting. Moving on to our backflow program. I know I presented last time. We've now fully transferred the backflow tracking to a third party, which has also freed up time for our staff to do their to do more for the system, and we're in transition right now working out the kinks, but it's already helped out a lot, and the customers seem to be taking to it pretty well too. So, and lastly, we've been working on a meter study on our commercial meters to examine if they are running slow, if we're experiencing lost revenues through old meters. What we found preliminarily is that they're actually in pretty good shape, and that even the Valor meter people were surprised at how little we are losing from these meters. And that's commending my staff that, you know, they stay on top of the meters. If they're broken, they fix them. And if they're, you know, causing problems, they'll replace them and et cetera. So it's been a good study, and it's shown that we're actually running a pretty tight ship. So that's some good news also to report. So that's all I had. I'll kick it off to Andy, unless anyone has any questions.
Thanks, Eddie. So on the wastewater side, from a staffing standpoint, we've got one retirement that we're anticipating on our sewer lines crew side. Kind of a surprise one we weren't seeing, but we're hearing rumors he hasn't come to us with an exact date yet, but that's what we're, he's indicated that that's coming soon. On the sewer lines side again, the CCTV project is underway, that the next phase of it. That's going well. We're generally in the western side of town at the moment, so if you see Dr. Pipeline truck out there, that's what they're doing. The treatment plant phase two work there was completed in December. It was a little ahead of schedule. Consultant's still finishing up the integration and the SCADA side of it. That was separate from the main construction contract, so they're getting that finished now. Did come in a couple thousand low on the construction side of that. We're doing some considerations right now on a possible change order for some electrical upgrades, basically some more emergency type breakers, things like that, that not available unless you get lucky and find them on eBay kind of thing for making a 400 amp breaker that doesn't exist anymore. So one of those things that keeps you up at night if that died. And then the effluent reuse master plan that is finally going to the Board of Supervisors this Thursday. So once that gets in place and our contract is in place, we'll get going on that. Otherwise, that's what I got on my side.
Sounds like a busy summer for both of you, and please pass on congratulations for the promotions and the retirements. With that, that will close out item 2C. So we're looking for any future agenda items. I don't have anything other than, obviously, stormwater one more time. Was it fourth time's a charm? Randy?
I would. One thing that I always, you know, when we see these CIPs that are presented, I think it's important for the public to see what goes into generating these, whether it's an asset management program or numerology. There's thought that goes into it, and I think for a future agenda item, it would be beneficial for me and hopefully the public to see what goes into how these projects are selected. So hopefully in the future. First comment. The other comment was, I really have to hand it to staff and the consultants. Having been through rate studies and recommendations before, it's so easy to get stuck in the weeds and lose sight overall of the direction and what has to be accomplished. And ultimately, the client is the group of citizens. Those are the ones that we have to balance against the needs of the system. So again, hats off to staff and to the consultants.
Thanks, Randy. Anything else for future agenda items? No? All right. With that, open it up to public comment. I think our public all left. We'll close public comment. I'll look for a motion to adjourn.
Can I?
Oh,
sorry. Sorry there, Mr. Chair. Back to item three or however, but we do need to schedule our next meeting. And as part of that, tentatively, we would then cover a revisit of stormwater as it was discussed today. And I would just put out there for consideration that maybe we hold our next meeting the latter part of March, and then we would also be bringing you the draft budget for fiscal year 21 would be at that same meeting, which is the time frame that finance likes to present that. So open for your consideration. Last year we held that meeting on March 26, and I just wondered if March 24 in the afternoon, that's a Tuesday afternoon, if that might work.
Yeah, I can make that work.
Okay. Yes, we'll look into that. It really hinges on finance and those, when they bring their budgets. If it's too early, they don't have the information, and if it's too late, then it gets in the way of what they're trying to do, at the big. So we'll check on that. So the week before or the week after, maybe. Is there any other conflicts up here in terms of people being out of town or anything we would need to work on with that March timeframe?
Yeah, I mean, I don't recall we've met on Friday in the past, but that Friday the 27th, I'm out.
Okay.
But otherwise, I think we just handle this over email. So
okay. Yeah, that's what we'll shoot for. Okay. With the idea of stormwater and then the budgets, and then Member Bowling heard your comment on the CIPs. Maybe we could save that for the May meeting. That's kind of when we ratify the budget. It's a little shorter discussion, and hopefully we'll be done with stormwater at that point. So that would be a good time to take on that, if that's okay.
That sounds good. No other comments? I'll look for a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
First, second.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
We're adjourned. Thank you, everyone.